Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
This is True Crime Cast. Jamie here with John. It's May, buddy.
It's May. Can't believe it. This year is flying by.
We're recording this one of the first few days of May. But yeah, this year is flying by. May is Crime Con month. I'm getting prepped and ready to go.
Oh, man, I forgot to show you.
Super excited.
We have some swag that came in, and I let you walk right by it coming into the studio and didn't show it to you.
That's okay. I'll catch it on the way out. Really excited for what we have to give away and the people we get to meet. Again, if you're interested in going, TCC10 will get you 10% off your badge to get in. If you are on the fence about going, please take my word for it. These are your people. If you listen to us, these are your people, and it's a great community, and I love going.
I went for the first time last year and was completely blown away at how well done everything was, the quality of speakers that they have in presenting, and then Podcast Row, or what they call Creators Row. I mean, I was like a fanboy because some of my podcasts that I listened to for enjoyment were there, and it was absolutely incredible. So usually flights to Vegas are fairly reasonably priced. So yep, no matter where you are in the world, get to Vegas and come experience Crime Con with us.
Yep. It's a good time. We can't wait for that. But before we do, we have, we got a case today, man. That's a big one. It's fascinating. It has so many lingering questions still. What is it? 35 years since this happened. So crazy.
Yeah. Well, man, why don't you get the ball rolling?
We're going to go back to Easter Sunday on 1991. You and I were not even 10 years old yet.
Nope.
So little kids. But there was a teenager working at a gas station in Bloomington, Illinois. His name was Bill Little, and this was one of his regular shifts. Sunday afternoon at this gas station was usually pretty laid back, and especially on Easter, a lot of people being busy. Bloomington, kind of the epitome of the Midwest, a small town, know just about everybody around, but he ended up not having a normal shift that day. At some point during the night, somebody came into the gas station and killed Bill Little for less than $100. And the amount varies depending on who you talk to. The managers of the gas station said that anytime the cash register got $60 over 100, they would have to go put that 60 in the safe, and only kept 100. So some level under 100 was in the cash register.
There's no amount of money that would be worth taking someone's life, but to know that, you know, he would have given them everything in the register, and yeah, such a senseless crime.
It really is. Across town, there was a guy named Jamie Snow. And he says that he was having Easter dinner with his 5 kids. However, he was eventually arrested for this murder and has been in jail for 25 years for killing Bill Little. So we're going to go through the case of Bill's murder, talk about what happened, and then talk a lot about Jamie. And we've been in contact with some of his advocates and hoping to do some interviews, but we don't do the wrongful conviction thing a lot in the form of advocacy, but I'm interested to see kind of where you fall on that spectrum at the end of this, John.
Yeah, we're going to walk through the trial and kind of see what, you know, each side says. We're going to listen to the defense. We're going to listen to the prosecution, kind of come away hoping that I'll fall one way or the other. And we can certainly process it, and very much could be the thing that I may walk away with, and I don't know.
Right.
But it's interesting. We will eventually have a follow-up bonus episode with advocates of Jamie Snow or even Jamie himself from prison.
To set the scene a little bit, this was 1991. There were not cameras everywhere. There was no cell phone data to track people's locations. And there was not even like, You're not using credit cards at the pump at this time, really, very much. Not at the pump for sure, but you can go in and pay. So this, like, put yourself in the 80s. That's pretty much where, I know it's 91. Let's just live in the 80s so there's no confusion here. And there was very little to work with. They had the body of Bill Little that was shot and laying in the floor. They had missing money. They had some fingerprints. There were shoe prints in the blood, but that's really all we got. And they were under a ton of pressure to catch this killer because the town of Bloomington has less than, I think, 2 murders a year, what I saw, like, on average. So this does not happen a lot. The town was very in unrest over this. So Crow started searching for a suspect and eventually would circle around to Jamie Snow.
Yeah, let me just give you a little bit more information about the crime scene, and then we'll get into the rest of the details. But there was a silent alarm that was activated around 8:16 p.m. on that Easter Sunday. That was April the 7th, 1991. Bill, again, was working at a gas station. It was on East Empire Street in Bloomington, Illinois. And like you said earlier, there was about $60 or so that was taken from the register. There was a witness at the scene. He had pulled in for some gas shortly before the murder. He saw a man arguing with Bill inside. He said that Bill's hands were shaking as he handed over the money. And that's when he left and returned after hearing the shooting. We'll get more into those details in a little bit, but I want to switch gears now and talk a little bit about Jamie Snow. Jamie Snow had no violent crimes in his past, but he had some other legal issues. He had a petty theft conviction from 1985, so that would be roughly 6 years before this incident. He had a few other brushes with the law, so the detective, Crow, took a closer look at him. Don't really know what prompted that look to begin with. You know what I mean? Like, what about this made him initially look into Crow? But as the investigation continued, Crow came to the conclusion that Snow, Jamie Snow, did not fit the profile of someone who would commit murder for less than $100. He even gave Jamie Snow a lie detector test, which Snow passed. I know you don't love those, but I do think it's interesting that this guy passed his lie detector test. Crow eventually retired in 1997. This was 6 years after Bill was killed. And he had never made any arrests in the case. Now, once Crow retired, the case was given to 2 rookie detectives. Those were Dan Katz and Rick Barks. So when they got onto the scene, or to the crime rather, this was a cold case, but they made an arrest.
Yeah, and in this time, Jamie had moved on to Florida, which I'm sure some people will say, of course, he moved away to avoid suspicion, but he got down there and he started trimming trees. That was his job. And he saved enough money to start his own company. He rented a home and was making a good life for his family down there. But we know that Katz and Barks were eager to make a big splash earlier in their careers, and this case was a big one in the community. So they thought if they could solve this murder, they would set themselves up for a really strong career. When they opened Crow's file, they started building a case, and immediately they identified Snow as a suspect, despite there being no evidence to tie him to the crime scene.
I mean, he was pretty much written off by the main detective at the time, Crow, but then they opened up the file, saw that he was initially a suspect, and sounded like they just kind of honed in on him.
Well, they got some people to tell them that they heard Snow confess to these crimes. And this is something that we talk about often. It was people, you mentioned that Snow did not have a violent criminal past, but he had been in jail for some lesser crimes. And during that time, allegedly, he confessed to people he was in jail with. So we're talking about jailhouse informants here. We're talking about snitches coming forward and saying, Jamie Snow told me he did this. 10 years after the murder, 2001, with the testimony of the jailhouse informants, Katz and Barks went ahead and arrested Jamie Snow and charged him. And the audio of this is readily available. And you can tell when they're talking to him, when they first tell him what happened, he is just so shocked that he is here to talk about this crime. But they charge him, arrest him, read him his rights, and the rest is history.
Jailhouse informants, I do think there are definitely times when what they're telling you is accurate information. But I do think as a detective, if I were a detective, I would be thinking in the back of my head, like, you know, they have something to gain by this. Even if it's not factual information, if it leads to an arrest and a conviction, you know, they're looking at potentially greatly reducing their jail time. So they have a rather large incentive to give you information, but I do think that there could be a temptation to not give you factual information.
Yeah, it's they certainly are often incentivized, and supposedly they're supposed to have to disclose that during the trial so the jury can hear exactly what they are being offered in exchange for their testimony. But sometimes that's not disclosed, sometimes that's under the table, and sometimes it just doesn't matter.
So let's talk about one of these informants. So the first one that was used by the prosecution was named Bruce Rowland. So Rowland claimed that Snow confessed to him that he killed Bill Little. However, when questioned about the incident during a lie detector test, he, Rowland, failed. So again, Jamie Snow took a lie detector test and passed, showing no deception. Rowland says that Jamie Snow confessed to it, but then when doing so on a lie detector test, he failed.
And I just want to say that, like, I poo-poo on lie detector tests all the time. If you've listened to the show, you know that. But for them to be doing, it's not evidence you can admit in trial. So in my opinion, for them to be using this as an investigative tool means they really trust it, that they do believe it's going to give them information that will lead them to the truth. So I think it's something they trust and want to rely on, but here they have their suspect passing it and the witness failing it. So in my mind, if you trust it and you get those results, you kind of have to pivot, but they didn't.
Well, interesting word there, trust. So on the stand during the trial, Rowland denied that he was given a deal for his testimony, but records show that his cooperation was taken into consideration for his sentencing in an unrelated crime. So there very much was some kind of an incentive, even though, you know, it's not a definitive, like, we're going to only sentence you to X. It was, quote unquote, taken into consideration and therefore reduced from what it could have been.
Which makes it, again, that's the under the table loophole situation that I hate.
Yeah. So there's another jailhouse informant, Kevin Shale, who was also denied receiving a deal, but records showed that he received an early release from prison for providing valuable information to a murder trial. So two informants both saying, nope, no deal was offered, but records show otherwise.
Well, it wasn't just two. There are more. The next one's name is Ronnie Wright, and he has actually recanted his story. In an affidavit, Wright said that he and Jamie Snow got into an argument over a card game when they were in the county jail together. Wright got mad and made his claim to the state that Snow had confessed to him. So according to Wright, he didn't approach authorities with this, or they didn't approach him with this. He approached them because he was mad at Jamie Snow over this argument. But in an affidavit, he said, all the testimony implicating Jamie Snow that I gave at trial was a lie. I was mad at Jamie and wanted to get even for what he had previously done in the county jail. I was able to answer all the prosecutor's questions with detail because I had read all the discovery materials, which also you're not supposed to give to witnesses. So here he is saying pretty clearly, I only did this because I was mad. Nothing I said was true. So
I wonder if Jamie had given him those materials because he thought they were close, and that's how he had that information, and he ended up, you know, potentially using that against him when he got mad at him.
Right. That's a good question, and I don't know when on the timeline he says he got this confession, but yeah, that's three jailhouse informants, two lied about getting benefits, and one said he lied about the actual confession.
There were also allegations that inmates were pressured to give testimony. For example, there's a man named Ed Palumbo. He said that he was threatened by the state's attorney. He said that if I didn't testify, I would be put in segregation in prison and be charged with perjury and get 5 years in prison for not cooperating. So that's a rather large negative incentive. You know, some of these incentives are going to help you, but this one is going to hurt you by 5 years of your life. That's if that is true, that is a big deal.
Right. And I think this is something that authorities wouldn't put on paper, but yeah, they would absolutely say it to his face because they can lie and do whatever they want.
Absolutely. Palumbo said that the prosecutor told him that Snow didn't commit the crime, but since they couldn't get that other person, Jamie would have to do. Now, again, those are allegations. We don't know if that is 100% what was said or what wasn't said. Steve Scheel also claimed that he agreed to testify after being put in prison, and he was put in segregation in prison in order to pressure him to cooperate. Again, this is what was allegedly told to Palumbo, that he would be put in segregation to put pressure on him. This guy, Steve Scheel, eventually agreed to stop his harassment in prison, even though he had failed a polygraph test about Snow's crime. So he talked to detectives and gave them what they needed to hear, but his polygraph test said that that was also deceptive.
So now we're at five jailhouse informants, two of them saying they were pressured to give this testimony for threat of a worse sentence, two that received benefits they lied about, and one that is fully recanted, which I guess you can say these two claiming they were threatened recanted as well. When we get back from the break, we'll talk about the other eyewitnesses to the crime, what they had to say, and whether or not that's reliable. Numbers vary based on when you look at when recantations happened, which ones are on the record, which ones are off the record, but as many as 15 witnesses have recanted their testimony against Jamie Snow. And I mean, that's a lot. And I feel like it happens sometimes where people recant because they really didn't remember. They say they were under pressure, but usually not up to 15 people. That's definitely a rarity. Now let's dive into the eyewitnesses. Gerardo Gutierrez was at the gas station 45 minutes before Bill was killed. He claimed that he saw a suspicious person arguing with Bill. And initially he described the person as having pierced ears and a scar on his chin, neither of which I'm sure you expect applied to Jamie Snow. Gutierrez said he went inside the gas station to pay for his gas, and he saw Bill's hand shaking because he was so upset from this confrontation that he had gone through with the unknown individual.
This is an 18-year-old kid. I mean, shoot, we've got kids around this age, and I know, you know, it's legally you're an adult, but holy crap, man, like, I'm a 40-something-year-old man, and you have someone robbing me. It's traumatic. I can't imagine what this kid was feeling.
Well, I think he's seeing him after an argument before the robbery. So he's just had it out with somebody, and this is what Gutierrez is saying here. But you're right. I've have seen each other after confrontations with people, and it's not a comfortable thing for either of us or really anybody.
Yeah. I mean, that's what, like, even as an old man, like, I don't like having a confrontation.
When he got home, Gutierrez heard about the shooting, and then he went back to the gas station to tell them what he had seen, which kudos to him for being willing to do that. A lot of people would try to stay away from it, not want to get involved. And so one way to look at that is kudos to him. Another is, this was 45 minutes before it happened. How relevant is this? But his information led police to release a sketch composite of the shooter. And again, this is somebody with earrings, a scar on their chin, did not look anything like Jamie Snow. Gutierrez was given multiple opportunities to identify Snow in lineups and in photo lineups, and never once picked Jamie Snow out of these lineups to say, this is the guy I saw arguing with Bill Little.
Yeah, and I mean, like you said, this was 45 minutes before that silent alarm was triggered. So just because this guy had a confrontation with Bill doesn't mean he came back and tried to, or killed Bill.
Right, yeah, so. Yeah. So this could be related, not necessarily, but also Gutierrez, if he's sticking his nose in this just because he wants to be a part of the process, you'd think he would, lean toward the defendant or lean toward who authorities were pushing him toward. So I think this is perhaps evidence that shows that he did have the right motive here.
Yeah. I don't know. What are the chances, I guess, it's definitely possible. I'm not saying it's not, but what are the chances that Bill would have this confrontation and less than an hour later he's dead? So potentially two separate individuals. That's, I think Occam's razor would suggest that this person got mad at Bill for some reason and came back to retaliate. But it's definitely possible that, you know, there was something else that happened.
Excellent point. Yeah, that I think that would be very unlikely. I can't imagine this. If he was getting into it with people every day, he probably wouldn't have still been working there, or we would have found out about it.
Yeah. So there was a second eyewitness that we want to talk about. This was 14-year-old Carlos Luna. So Carlos and Juan Luna, these were both teenagers, brothers. They lived across the street from the gas station, and it was probably 220 feet or so between the house and the gas station. So the boys claimed that they were looking out the window to see if one of their family members was working at the gas station, because if they were, they could go over and get some candy. I mean, my gosh, I'm, again, 40-year-old man. If you worked at a gas station, I'd be hitting that up, getting some sweet tarts. You know what I mean?
Right.
Both boys said that they saw a man leave the station, but they did not get a good enough look to help to get the composite sketch drawn up. Even though they said they didn't really get a good look, police brought the boys in to view a lineup. Carlos took a guess and ended up picking Snow. So there's how you know, really get the investigation narrowed in on Snow. He said, this is Carlos, he said that I imagined every one of them doing it, and he came to mind and fit the picture. Today, Carlos has now redacted his ID, saying that he can't be sure if who he saw that night was Jamie Snow. I mean, from the get-go, this is a teenage boy who said, I didn't get a good look at him, and I had to imagine all of those people doing this, and Jamie Snow fit the one who basically could do that best. So how in the world this is even considered a positive ID is absurd to me.
Yeah, I mean, he's a 14-year-old kid. I don't trust my kids to tell me where they put their backpack after school. This is eyewitness testimony is shaky at best. And if you add in that it's a teenager who's confused, is in a police station, that's a pretty, I don't know, it's almost perfectly put together to get some false information there. Now we'll get to the star witness for the prosecution, who is Danny Martinez. Danny testified at trial that he saw Jamie Snow leaving the gas station at the time of the murder. So now this is the first time we have somebody saying, this is who I saw. It's at the right time and the right place. He told jurors that Jamie Snow's eyes were unforgettable, something that he would never forget. He says he was putting air in his tires at the service station parking lot, and when he finished, he walked toward the building and saw somebody else walking out. At that moment, he heard what he thought was a car backfiring, so he turned back and looked at his car to check. He saw his car was okay, and as he turned around, he says he ran into the shooter, like turned around and walked chest to chest into this guy. Now, at the time of the shooting, Martinez did not say that this was Snow, even though he had opportunities to do so. Plus, Martinez and Snow were childhood friends, so you'd think if he saw Jamie Snow there, that's an easy identification, especially if his eyes are something you don't forget. And this is your friend. That's an immediate recognition there. They have played sports together, so you'd think picking him out of a lineup would be easy. He looked at lineups and picture books and narrowed it down to two men. Again, this is in the immediate aftermath. But neither of the guys he narrowed it down to were Jamie Snow. At the time, he claimed that he didn't see Snow and he thought Snow was innocent. But by the time that Jamie gets arrested and he's working with the two new detectives, his story is completely different as far as who he saw and how he knew who it was.
Then within weeks of the trial, the prosecution called Martinez into a private meeting at the state attorney's office. During that meeting, Martinez suddenly changed his story, identified Snow in a lineup as the shooter, and he was removed from the defense witness list and added to the prosecution's list. Martinez was also known to the first police officer on the scene of the murder, Jeffrey Pilo. Now, Pilo made statements at the time that proved that Martinez and his claim were false. After the trial and conviction, Pilo said that after he first arrived at the gas station, he saw Martinez filling his tires with air, and then he saw Martinez walk towards the building, turn back to look at his vehicle, and then Martinez got into his car and drove off, never running into anyone else.
So he corroborates half of Martinez's story, that he was filling his car with air and that he looked back at his car as if he heard a backfire, but then completely different after that.
Yeah, he would go on to say, "I am absolutely positive that from the time I arrived at the Empire and Landon intersection in response to the 1090, which is a holdup panic alarm, the time that I eventually entered the gas station, no one other than Bill Little was either in the gas station or entered or exited the gas station. I had a clear, unobstructed view of the gas station door and was focusing on the gas station because I was concerned about the call and the fact that I couldn't see anyone inside." Unfortunately, Pilo was later convicted on multiple rape charges and is serving a 440-year prison sentence, and this greatly damaged his credibility, but his story is backed up by recorded radio calls and a recorded police interview from 1999. These recordings prove that his statements have remained consistent from day one. This interview was not used at trial and only became available to Snow when he went pro se, which means he was representing himself. That was back in 2004 and received his discovery so he could represent himself.
So we have first cop on the scene responding to the silent alarm that says, "I saw the key witness and what he's saying isn't true." However, how would you feel, John, if you were innocent of a crime and the only person that could prove it ended up being a rapist that nobody trusted?
I would be furious right off the bat, but then when I would hear about that, I mean, I would just be livid is not even close enough to what I would be.
Yeah, like that's almost so bad that it's hard to believe that it would be true. So I found that pretty fascinating. Another big focus of the investigation once Katz and Barks took over, just throwing this out here, that his name's Barks and the other one's Katz, kind of like cats and dogs.
Yeah.
Just a great,
my mind went there too.
Great detective team. So this was part of the prosecution's case, was that Snow's sister-in-law, Suzanne Claycomb, drove the getaway car. However, there's nothing. She had no evidence that she had been with them. She really didn't know the details of the crime scene inside. And actually, she was charged with the same charges that Jamie was, because she was an accessory to this crime. And here's where her role gets kind of fascinating. She was offered probation by the prosecution in exchange for testifying against her brother-in-law, Jamie Snow. But her attorney advised her not to take this deal because he felt strongly about the prosecution's case being weak. So she denied the deal, went to trial, and he ripped the prosecution's case apart. And Claycomb was acquitted. And then she was brought in to testify for the defense at the Jamie Snow trial. So she was on a trial with the same charges with similar evidence, and she was acquitted. and went to testify for Jamie. Unfortunately, apparently Jamie Snow's attorney wasn't as good as that of Susan Claycomb's.
No, unfortunately, it was not. Snow was given a public defender, and by recent accounts, and you know, a lot of accounts rather, this guy was not the most competent. First of all, Snow's attorney failed to expose the jailhouse informants and eyewitnesses, and how they were given, you know, some pretty major incentives to testify, and you know, didn't even pass a lot of their polygraph tests when they were given those. He didn't point out the fact that Snow's alleged accomplice was exonerated, but Snow was convicted, and that just shows that this defense attorney didn't do his best job. Snow was given a life sentence, and he is still serving that today. Since his conviction, Snow has elected to represent himself, giving him access to his full discovery. He discovered that there were 950 pages of discovery materials that was given to his defense team, but there were another 7,750 pages that were never turned over. So, Jamie, we covered something like this a few weeks ago, which, do you remember what that law was called?
Brady violation.
So this is a potential Brady violation.
I mean, it's a pretty clear one, if true, and a Brady violation is grounds for overturning a conviction. So this is a big part of the question of why things have happened the way they have.
These pages contained information about other possible suspects that could have raised enough reasonable doubt to change the outcome of his trial. There's also evidence that remains untested today. There were blood and fingerprints left at the crime scene that had never been properly analyzed. There were also bullets recovered from William's body and William's clothing. Snow has repeatedly requested these pieces of evidence be tested, and those motions have been denied. The appeals courts have said that testing would only prove that someone was at the gas station, but would not prove that Snow was innocent.
Right. And that's a big, the appeal piece is a big burden. So I think what part of this would show is that A, Snow, if none of his fingerprints are there, you could say maybe he wasn't there, but the absence of proof isn't proof of absence, if you will. So that doesn't necessarily prove he wasn't there. But maybe if they find fingerprints from one of the suspects, that could be something. 5 years after his conviction, his defense attorney was disbarred and sent to prison for stealing the life savings of an elderly woman while being her power of attorney. So not only was he incompetent, he was dirty. He admitted he suffered from mental illness, alcoholism, and a gambling addiction. In October of 2025, the Illinois Supreme Court denied hearing Snow's case. To this day, the original Detective Crow says he believes that Snow is innocent because he was the one that investigated Snow initially and said, I don't think it was him. So he's still serving out that life sentence at the Illinois River Correction Center. And he transferred in there in order to complete his master's degree. So he's been in prison for 25 years, trying to make the most of his time there. But this is why we were contacted by his advocates, John, is that based on what we've covered, and I feel like I may have let my hand tip in the way that I talked about this and being dismissive of certain witnesses, but I just cannot believe that there's enough evidence here to convict anybody. If the bar is beyond reasonable doubt, I don't think this gets close to that. And as far as I'm concerned, as far as we could find, we didn't leave anything out. I don't think we're leaving any big evidence pieces off the table here. Again, my tone was probably revealing. I don't think he should be in prison. Do I think he's innocent? I don't know, but he shouldn't be in prison for this right now.
Yeah, I mean, if you just go back to what you know at the time of the trial, I think there's enough there for reasonable doubt. There's no physical evidence that puts him there. And then the only thing you really have is testimony. Now, if you fast forward and you know all this other stuff that has since come out, I feel like he has every bit of a legal foothold to at least get another trial.
Right. And to be clear, the original jury didn't hear a lot of the deals that the testimony got, the jailhouse informants. They didn't obviously hear the recantations of the other suspects. So it's a situation where the jury didn't have the full picture. But I think with the picture they did have, I still have a hard time believing that he should have been convicted beyond a reasonable doubt.
Yeah, I'm really interested to continue this conversation. We are in talks right now with some of his advocate team, and there's a possibility that we could even have an interview with Jamie from prison. You know, I guess I don't know where I'm going to land. I think at the time, if I were on the jury, I still think there's room for reasonable doubt. But now, looking at it from the perspective that we have, there's a lot more ways that I could say there would be reasonable doubt. But yeah, I think we need to continue this conversation for sure. I want justice. You know, if Jamie did not murder Bill, then justice has not been served, and now there's an injustice being done to Jamie.
Right. I'm glad you brought that up. I want to make sure the focus is on, we need to get the guy that killed Bill Little. And I don't think that's Jamie Snow. I don't think he should have been convicted. I think at minimum he deserves a new trial. But we need to find the person that killed Bill Little, because if it wasn't Jamie, then justice has not been served for him in any capacity.
Right.
Making another victim doesn't make the
two case, wrongs right. Don't make a right.
I've heard that.
Yep. Guys, we really appreciate you all tuning in each and every week. We didn't mention it at the beginning of the episode, but please don't forget about Patreon. There's a brand new episode up for our Patreon members only. We have May's episode up, so go check that out, and you get all of our other content early and ad-free.
Yeah, it's a pretty wild one about southeastern Kentucky, where I'm from. So we'd love to have you all over there. And as always, please leave a review. We'll read those on the air. It's a great way to recommend cases and to let us know what you think.
Guys, we appreciate you again. And until next crime, this has been True Crime Cast.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.